This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today, we're talking about environmental issues in Indiana, what's gotten better, what stayed the same, and what changes some advocates hope for in the years ahead. Joining us for the full hour today is Jesse Carbonda, executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Carbonda recently announced he's leaving the group after nearly 14 years. Welcome to the program, Jesse.
It's great to be with you, Miriam.
Let's talk about your experience at the State House first before we get into more detailed work that you do. If you think back to some of the biggest legislative accomplishments you were involved in, are there any common threads between them?
I think that the common thread is protecting the ability of local governments to better the environment. You know, the backdrop is that Indiana has historically been a home rule state, which has empowered local governments to do good. And to do good in ways that are very much customized to the needs of the community. And in 1980, that was enshrined in a home rule law. And so what we found ourselves winning on, although they've been fierce battles, is preventing efforts to repeal and weaken the ability of local governments to protect the environment, whether it comes to stormwater pollution or factory farm pollution or other issues.
When you look at the work that you've been able to do, do you think your group's time and energy is spent more on blocking legislation you don't want to happen or passing legislation that you do want?
I'm afraid it's the former, that what we found over the years, as the complexion of the General Assembly has changed, it has shifted us from being able to put forward a lengthy, proactive legislative agenda to blocking things that could put our air and water in a worse position. But I will say, Miriam, that we always try to do both meaningfully stop legislation that really, again, could be adverse to the public interest, but at the same time foster solutions like solar energy and mass transit that will, again, put our economy and our environment in a better position.
It seems like around the country, not just in Indiana, there's a lot of efforts to block legislation to fight against things. Do you have any sense of why this is becoming such an issue?
Gosh, there's so many different factors, Miriam. You know, I would kind of boil them down into economic, legal, and political. Economic, I would say that, you know, there's been a precipitous change in traditional media, and it's meant that even though there are some excellent environmental-minded reporters in Indiana and across the country, there are a lot less of them. And that means that there isn't the kind of watchdogging that can happen, and people aren't getting the precise information that they need. So that's kind of an economic change, since the business model for journalism has drastically changed over the decades. The other piece is legal, which is that we have very severe gerrymandering in Indiana. And what it does is it leads to a situation where the elections really don't happen in the fall. They happen in the primary season. And in primaries, it's ideological-minded voters, not pragmatic voters, that tend to dominate in these elections. And that elects people who are fiercely ideological. And oftentimes, that translates into being very anti-government. So that's another major reason why we're spending so much time. And then, you know, to state the obvious, the nature of conservatives has changed from the 80s, when you had someone like Governor Orr advance very protective force policy as governor in the late 70s and 80s, to today, where we saw this really drastically bad piece of public policy get passed in the General Assembly called SB 389, which severely weakens protection for wetlands.
I remember doing some shows about that legislation. Is there anything that's changed in terms of that? Has anything come out of the work that you've been doing?
Oh, with respect to wetlands?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, I mean, the one redemptive piece in 389 is it created a wetlands task force. And the governor, to his credit, has named a number of very informed, experienced people to that task force. And they'll be convening soon. There isn't an initial date of that task force, but the goal of it is that over a series of months of meeting, they will propose some policy recommendations that essentially give a fresh look to wetlands policy. The irony is that this shouldn't have been the process. The process should have been you create a task force that recommends good public policy, and then you pass that public policy. What instead happened was we dramatically repealed a bipartisan 2005 wetlands policy with really little scientific data to back and justify its passage.
It sounds like it's kind of the opposite, where instead of a task force recommending things, it's like, let's pass it and see what sticks, and then we can fix things down the road.
Exactly. And, you know, we've seen that, too, with respect to solar energy, where, you know, rooftop solar can be an incredible source of electricity in Indiana and across the country. In fact, the National Renewable Energy Lab has concluded that we can get about 40% of America's electricity from rooftop solar and other technologies that are called distributed generation. And tragically, in 2017, Indiana passed SB 309, which phases out the most important program in our state to accelerate rooftop solar. And again, they did it without any underlying study.
What do you think that reveals about Indiana politics with regards to the rooftop solar bill?
You know, I think it reveals the grip that the special interests have on public policy. And I think for people who followed the Hoosier Environmental Council's work over the years and my approach to environmental issues, you know, I'm always looking for the silver linings. And I think that the public can mobilize and has mobilized in very inspirational ways and in very victorious ways. But there's no question that the underlying challenge that we face, both with respect to rooftop solar policy and wetlands policy and others, is the incredible might of special economic interests in shaping the decision-making of lawmakers.
You mentioned looking for silver linings. How do you keep going in this field when it seems like there's just so much against you?
I think it's the conviction that we can never stop expanding the coalition of people who care. You know, one of the most noteworthy developments that's happened over the nearly 14-year tenure that I've been executive director of Hoosier Environmental Council is that people of faith are really mobilizing. And, you know, historically, kind of theologically liberal people of faith have been involved in the environmental movement. But what we're seeing now is evangelicals and conservative Catholics really stepping up and speaking up, and people of non-Christian faiths doing so as well. So that's a hopeful sign. And I think there's, you know, young people mobilizing around climate action is another tremendous source of positivity. So I think there's limitless potential, even in a state like Indiana, which is culturally conservative, to keep building this broad big tent movement for environmental progress.
You mentioned evangelicals, and I'm curious what you think of if they're becoming more environmentally concerned. What is causing that? I think because just traditionally there's this impression that the evangelical movement is very conservative.
I think back to time I spent with Reverend Mitch Hescox, who's the executive director of the Evangelical Environmental Network. And what he really taught me, we had a lot of time in the car going from one place to another when we hosted him here in Indiana for our big signature event, which is called Greening the State House. And what Reverend Hescox really made me appreciate is that there are very different segments of the evangelical community. And the segment that simultaneously takes the Bible seriously, as well as really embraces mainstream science, has come to the conclusion that, you know, God is calling them to act, to safeguard creation, and that science provides the tools to help solve and sort of honor God.
You fought for a piece of legislation concerning county governments dealing with factory farms. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was and what happened there?
Sure. You know, this has been an issue that's come up in more than a few legislative sessions. And the common concept is sort of to kind of appreciate why this matters so much. You know, we so poorly deal with the pollution that's caused by these factory farms. So a given factory farm may have a waste pit that is acres in size, and it doesn't have any covering, and it generally doesn't have any lining. And so it serves as a source of air pollution risk as well as water pollution risk. And one of the battles that we fought, which you're referencing, is this effort on the part of the legislature to basically repeal the ability of county governments to be able to enact public policies that could deal with the air and water pollution problems caused by these factory farms. And that the way that the county might deal with it is to establish a bigger setback from a school or from a home or from a water body. And again, the public policy that we're talking about here would repeal their ability to do that. And thankfully, by our helping to mobilize a pretty broad-based coalition, we were able to defeat that public policy.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking with Jesse Carbonda, executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, who recently announced he's leaving the group. And we're talking about environmental issues in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking about environmental issues in Indiana, where the state has come in the last couple decades, why it's been difficult to get big changes to happen at the State House, and what advocates are hoping for in the coming years. We're joined by Jesse Carbonda, outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, can you tell us more about the Hoosier Environmental Council for folks who may not know what you do?
Absolutely. Hoosier Environmental Council has been around for 38 years, and we are Indiana's largest environmental public policy organization. In a nutshell, what we do is to advance environmental health and justice, protect land and water, and accelerate climate solutions.
What are the specific issues that are right now at the top of the list for the council?
Well, under the realm of environmental health and justice, I would say coal ash and factory farming. These are two issues that, you know, while we've made inroads on other aspects of environmental progress, such as, you know, the fact that we have a lot more land that's under cover cropping, which is helping to reduce nutrient pollution on our crop farm fields, two areas that have been persistently a challenge for our state are factory farming and coal ash. You know, we have more coal ash waste pits than any state in America. And the way that we're handling the toxic metals that are leached into our groundwater is profoundly different from what's happening in southern states, which are just as conservative as in Indiana. So that's kind of a big area under environmental health. We also have a dedicated environmental justice initiative, which is focused on Indianapolis. And there we're trying to make sure that the principles of environmental justice are embedded into projects, into plans, into policy. In the realm of protecting our land and water, we have a special focus on trying to make sure that we're doing everything possible to protect endangered woodlands and wetlands across the state. And we are involved in a really incredible partnership in the Indianapolis area called Partners for the White River, which is making a very dedicated effort to reduce various sources of pollution to our majestic White River and bring it back to a place where it really becomes the crown jewel of central Indiana.
How do you choose what's a priority to tackle over other environmental issues? Because there's so much going on, it seems like. So how do you figure out which one is like number one and then number two, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. You know, it's a humbling exercise because there are so many needs that we have to address in our state. But fundamentally, I say it's a three-part test. Is the initiative that we're working on going to have a significant impact on improving environmental quality? That's test one. Test two is it going to have a beneficial impact on the economy? In other words, will it foster new jobs and investment alongside protecting the environment? That's test two. And then test three is, will it have an equity benefit either in terms of addressing imbalances in burdens facing people in our state, or from a climate perspective, are we helping to make sure that this initiative is making people who live past us better off?
You mentioned earlier the opportunity to show lawmakers what's happening. It might be one way to get them more interested to actually physically see something. Have you been able to do that at all? And if so, have you seen a dramatic shift in the way things were viewed?
I think it's something that we haven't pursued as consistently as we should have. We did have an instance, for example, several years ago where we took a combination of HEC members and elected officials to see a big renewable energy project up in White County. And there, you know, some of the misperceptions that some of these folks had about the technology, I think, were allayed. And, you know, the attitude about renewable energy in the State House is very different from what it was when I started back in 2007 at HEC. So I think that's a very concrete example. We've made some effort of taking them lawmakers out to see open space areas, but we have to do a lot more.
Is there any effort being made to find folks to run for government positions that have an environmental background? I wonder this because it just seems sometimes that if there's such a big disconnect between lawmakers and what's happening in the real world, we need some candidates that have some understanding of what's going on.
I agree. You know, as a 501c3 nonprofit, we can't get involved in candidate endorsements, but we certainly encourage people to run for office in a very generic sense. You know, we certainly encourage our members that to consider that as a pathway to addressing the fact that there aren't enough environmental champions in the State House. And, you know, that message, Miriam, is really a bipartisan one, which is to say that, you know, the polling shows that there are very different attitudes about the environment and climate between Democrats and Republicans. But I will say to you that there have been some really remarkable Republican champions for the environment in the State House as well. And so really, it's a message for both parties when I say, you know, run.
When it comes to your experience in environmental issues, it's clear you're passionate. You've been at this for a long time. Where did you get your start and how did you get involved in this area?
It's interesting. You know, in some ways, I'm a very unconventional environmentalist in the sense that I didn't grow up with parents who took me out to camping as a child. But I still had very meaningful experiences, you know, and I think the other sort of interesting aspect of this is, you know, I'm the son of immigrants. And so I'm not sure if immigrant families perhaps do that kind of camping as much as people whose families have lived in America for a long time. But in any case, I kind of trace three different sources for where my passion for the environment comes from. One is, it just so happens that I grew up in a part of suburban St. Louis in which my parents' home was adjacent to a large undeveloped parcel. And sometimes I would roam around there, and that certainly gave me a sense of the majesty of nature. You know, in addition to that, I was really blessed that my mother really believed that travel is a means of education. And so by the time my brother and I were in our teens, we had seen most of America and more than a few continents across the world, and certainly saw a lot of nature areas there. And then the third area that really, I think, sensitized me to environmental justice in particular is that you see this pronounced confluence between people who are poor and people who are suffering environmental burdens in a very pronounced way in developing countries. You know, a child that's begging for food in the middle of teeming amounts of traffic where there's a lot of diesel exhaust that child is having to inhale. So that really is kind of a very poignant influence in terms of shaping my care for environmental justice.
It's interesting you're mentioning the travel and seeing other parts of the world, because I'm wondering, there, I feel like, how am I going to put this? I'm trying to wrap my head around how I want to say this, but you know, when you go to other parts of the world and you see, for example, piles of burning trash, and some of it is actually coming from the United States, how can we, I guess, bring more attention to that for folks to understand, like, it's not just our bubble here. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, you know, that kind of speaks to, in some sense, what I hope to do after I depart HEC, which is to begin book writing and really helping to get people to pay more attention to the kind of interconnectivity between what we do here and what happens abroad. You know, I think about the fact that our society is very addicted to meat, and you know, that helps to fuel some of the damage that we're seeing abroad. I don't want to overstate it, but you know, I think about what happens in the Amazon, where a lot of the Amazon rainforest in Brazil has been lost to livestock agriculture. Now, a lot of that meat is used in South America or exported to Asia and Europe, but some of it goes to America. And so that shows that the consumption decisions we make here, the purchasing decisions we make here, does have repercussions across the planet. The other kind of more obvious example of this is that America has historically been the leading emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. And of course, climate change is having profound imprints across the globe.
If you're listening to us live, we'd love your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Jesse Carbonda, outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Jesse, have you seen any changes or patterns in the last 14 years of the work that you've been doing here in Indiana?
Well, you know, what's an interesting aspect of the Indiana story when it comes to the environment is it's almost like we have two narratives. We've got the narrative of the legislature, which has become increasingly grim in some sense because you have a large block of lawmakers who are really not interested in solving these big issues like coal ash and factory farming pollution. They're more interested in sort of sticking to a set of principles that essentially puts a worship of certain attitudes about government above doing what's right for the people, addressing real tangible problems. So that's a piece of the narrative that's kind of discouraging, although, again, I can furnish many examples of victories when the public mobilizes. The other narrative is that we have entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs and activists in Indiana who are doing incredibly inspiring things for the environment to such a degree that it's getting national attention. You know, I think about those corn and bean farmers who are at the forefront in America of cover cropping and no-till agriculture. I think of the climate activists, many of whom are in their high school years, who are helping to create climate public policies at the local level that have gotten national attention. So we've got an incredible number of talented and genuine and passionate people doing good work for the environment, but it's not being honored in terms of wise public policy that would put Indiana at the forefront. And that's a great change from what it once was. You know, Indiana was the first state in America, if I've got my facts straight, that banned the use of phosphorus-containing detergents in the early 1970s. So we really need to get back to that heritage of being an innovator in public policy for the environment.
Do you think we focus too much on negative outcomes, and that's why we're not noticing some of the wins here and there that have been made?
Well, you know, we try to do both. We try to give people the hard truth of problems that really would have an impact on people's drinking water or their air quality. But we also want to provide many examples of hope. And that's why I like to emphasize and talk about, you know, these amazing entrepreneurs who are, say, helping to create jobs in a underinvested part of rural Indiana in the realm of solar energy, or people who are, again, involved in solar energy who are very intentionally locating their business in underinvested areas in urban Indiana. So I think we've got to tell both stories, right? The positive stories give people hope. They give people encouragement that Indiana can be a leader, can help to solve these problems. But we have to be candid with everybody about the nature of the problems, because otherwise we're going to see people needlessly suffer.
Are you noticing any changes in the way the public thinks and talks about environmental issues?
I would say that it has become more mainstream. And what gives me a sense to say that is because I've been struck by the number of companies, corporations that have green teams within their company. And I don't see these as window dressing in terms of my personal experience. These are green teams where you have employees who earnestly want to green the operations of the company. It may be in more modest ways, like instituting recycling or composting, or having a dedicated parking spot for an electric vehicle or for a bike. Or it could be in more significant ways, which is to try to really influence executive leadership to
have a strong, aggressive climate action plan. So I think that's one example of how attitudes have changed about the environment. I think the way in which environmental stewardship and the notion of creation care has permeated people of faith, congregations of faith, I think has been a very positive example of kind of the cultural change we've seen in our state.
When it comes to environmental issues, I think a topic that often comes up is funding and whether there's enough to go around. Do you think there's enough? Has it been cut?
Yes. Unfortunately, funding, I'll give you two examples of where there's been cuts. One is in the realm of IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, basically the state's equivalent of the US EPA. And on a per capita basis, they've seen a decline, as well as an absolute basis, they've seen a decline in their funding since the early 2000s. And we've also seen it with respect to open space protection. You know, there's a very important initiative called the Benjamin Harrison Conservation Trust, and it is a source of helping to save woodlands and wetlands and prairies that are potentially vulnerable to development. And funding for that has declined significantly. So we really need to place a lot higher priority on the environment, not just for the sake of protecting wildlife and creating more beautiful spaces for people to enjoy, but because it really matters from an economic perspective. The recreational sector in Indiana alone employs about 140,000 people.
That's a lot of people. That's a pretty good number.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and one of the themes of my years in HEC is to really emphasize the fact that if we have the right public policies in place, we can pave the way for more of these types of what I would call, you know, sustainable economy jobs. I think about, again, solar energy, where we have so much promise to be a national leader in solar energy because we have so many, for example, warehouses in our state. We're trying to be a warehouse hub in the country because we do have a high density of highways. So that makes us a very logical place to have warehouses. But guess what? Almost none of them have any solar energy. And yet, if we were to put these solar panels up, we could help to obviously power our energy in emissions-free ways and also save land. You know, the new sources of energy, like utility-scale solar farms, do use a lot of land. Why not have that power come from our rooftops?
Have you heard of why companies wouldn't be interested in putting solar panels? Is it the cost?
Well, you know, the cost has gotten a lot better. Solar energy has declined on a megawatt basis, on a kilowatt basis, by 65 to 70% since a decade ago. So that definitely makes the economics of these projects better. But one of the problems is that the bill that I'd referenced earlier, SB 309, really hurts the economics of these rooftop solar projects. Indiana's in the minority of states that legislatively phased out this public policy called net metering. And furthermore, what we've seen happen in the implementation of net metering by way of what the utilities are doing, Duke Energy, AES Indiana, and the other three investor-owned utilities, is that they have interpreted SB 309 in a way that even further worsens the economics of these rooftop solar projects by eliminating this concept called net billing, which really, again, makes these projects more attractive.
We'll come back after a quick break and touch up more a little bit on this solar power. We're talking to the outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council about environmental issues in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing environmental issues in Indiana and what some advocates are hoping for in the coming years. With us is Jesse Carbonda, the outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We have a listener voicemail from Esther, who has a question about the safety of rivers and lakes in Indiana. Let's take a listen.
Hello, this is Esther from Hope, Indiana. when I was a graduating senior, our assignment in English was to write an article about something that we'd like to see changed in our community. And I wanted to have the fact that the local cannery was dumping raw sewage into the stream that, that ran into the Muscatatuck, and nothing was being done about it. And I told my teacher, and she said, we'll never put that article in because that company contributes to the school. I was just wondering, is there a place that we can go now to check the status of what certain water places are in now, rivers and lakes, and how safe they are in Indiana? Thank you.
Yes, that's a great question. And IDEM, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, has an impaired waters list, which gives the status of a lot of different segments of our rivers and streams. Not all of them, because they don't have the people power. And that speaks to your point about, Miriam, about funding. It doesn't have the people power to measure all of these rivers and streams. But certainly, if one goes to the IDEM website and looks up the impaired waters list, they'll be able to tell what the status of the river and stream is. Are they impaired for bacterial pollution or something else that's measured by our state government?
When it comes to the listener voicemail, she mentioned the company was funding the school, and that's why the teacher told her that this article wouldn't be published. Is that a common thing around Indiana where there's corporations tied to something and so nobody speaks about it?
Oh, my goodness. It happens a lot. And it's a real tragedy because, again, people suffer in silence. I can think of a company, I don't want to name it here on the radio, but again, a company that was causing concerns with respect to groundwater contamination, and the local government officials were absolutely fearful of bringing it up because they were worried that there would be less money going into the county community foundation and funding various school projects. So, and that's where I think groups like the Hoosier Environmental Council matter so much, because we obviously are very independent and make our decisions based on science and the need, and can call out these corporations if necessary. You know, in addition, we've talked a lot about during this program our legislative work, but we have a very vibrant legal program that when all else fails, we will sue a polluter and hold them accountable.
You mentioned that you don't want to say what the company is that's been doing that. Is it something I can guess, and you can tell me if that's who it is?
Well, there's actually a lot of different companies that are, there are a lot of good stewards of the environment among the business community, but then there are some that are very problematic. And, you know, we won't shy away from that purpose. You know, we have a very stringent donor process at Hoosier Environmental Council, so we don't accept money from companies that we would deem to be polluters. And that gives us the freedom to really act according to conscience.
But what would you do if one of the companies that is donating does end up having some issues dumping into the lake or something?
Well, I don't know if it would happen because our stringency of choosing businesses is so tough. I mean, we have a dedicated green business program where they really have to, we do a lot of research into their regulatory record to make sure they haven't had permit violations. And we carefully review and interview people in the company before we let them become a green business member of HEC. And even then, it only represents a few percentage of our total income. But to your question, if that were to happen, and it's really more of a hypothetical, we would, of course, no longer want to associate with them, return their money, and of course do what we think is right to protect the public, even if it means having to sue that company.
Yeah, I think it's hard for any organization whenever you're working with others, just knowing what other things they're involved in, and sometimes you have to make some tough choices. We have a question from Sharon on Facebook who says, surrounding states are calling for Indiana to cede its management of Lake Michigan due to poor recent performance. Why doesn't Indiana keep corporate polluters responsible? What can be done to improve water quality of Lake Michigan?
That's an excellent question, and of course, very motivated by these very significant episodes of contamination to Lake Michigan caused by U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal. And I think One way that we answer that question is by holding them legally accountable. We're working in very close partnership with the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, which incidentally is where I used to work. And they're our lawyer in a lawsuit against ArcelorMittal, and we are very keen to hold them accountable for their significant toxic pollution. And the idea is that if we are to prevail and achieve a settlement that that really, again, holds them accountable, it will have a signaling impact for other polluters on Northwest Indiana that they need to proactively step up their stewardship and avoid these types of this type of damage. And again, otherwise we'll hold them accountable. And no one wants to have that kind of bad press, and no one wants to have to fork out, you know, X number of dollars to try to settle a case. So we hope that has a deterrent effect on reducing pollution of Lake Michigan.
As someone that goes to Lake Michigan and different waterways, I think sometimes it's hard for folks to realize what's going on if they're not out there. You know, when you go out there and you see the trash or you see the flag saying you can't go in the water because it's contaminated. So how would you bring attention to these types of things for people who may not have access to those areas to understand what's going on?
We've put a lot of emphasis on the power of social media. We have the largest social media footprint, to my knowledge, of any environmental advocacy group in the state. And we use that to good effect by sharing photography, sharing videos, getting testimonials from those communities and spreading the word that way. And certainly, that worked to help mobilize people, for example, to fight against this terrible wetlands bill. There was some very moving footage that our colleagues out in East Central Indiana had sent us about one of their beautiful wetlands that they helped to protect. And, you know, that providing that very story of this wetland and what it does to store water and to purify the water and to serve as a habitat for birds helped to mobilize and move people that these are the types of, beautiful environments that could be destroyed. So whenever we can, we're very much about trying to share stories with the public, and we can do even more.
You've talked about wanting more engagement on environmental issues in rural Indiana. Why is that something you think needs some focus on?
Well, I think that the reason is both for the merits and for the politics. So what I mean by that is that we often, when we think about environmental justice, we often think about urban areas, and for good reason, because urban areas may be plagued by an industrial abandoned site that is causing leaching of some toxin into the groundwater, or it's leading to lots of particulate matter that's causing high rates of asthma in urban areas, but oftentimes communities of color. But rural Indiana also faces its own challenge. And I think about private drinking water wells, the fact that 1+ million Hoosiers are in private drinking water wells, mostly in rural Indiana, and they're exposed potentially to all sorts of contaminants. Whether that's from a breakdown in a landfill or from factory farm manure waste or from agrochemical runoff from pesticides or fertilizers, et cetera. So there's just the need to help address those very rural problems. But furthermore, the fact of the matter is that rural lawmakers are oftentimes the gatekeepers when it comes to energy and environmental policy in the state house. They are the chairpersons of the committees. And so you need to have a meaningful presence of supporters in their districts for them to really pay attention to these issues.
What would you like to see come out of the Indiana State House over the next 5 to 10 years?
Oh, goodness. Well, in the realm of solar energy, for example, I think we need to see Indiana adopt a suite of public policies that puts us at the very forefront of paving the way for rooftop solar, because it will be a great way of cutting carbon emissions, improving energy independence, making our grid more resilient and reliable. And so there's a whole suite of public policies there, including extending the life of net metering, which as it is going to expire next year. We want to see things like third-party solar and third-party financing and community solar, third-party community solar legislation become enacted as well. In the realm of water quality protection, I'd love to see a requirement that every river and stream must have a buffer around it. It would do a dramatic sense of good to to improve the quality of our rivers and lakes that are continuing to be plagued by stormwater runoff in urban areas and agrochemical runoff in rural areas. I'd love to see more money for the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. We're losing a lot of talent in those agencies because they're getting lured away by the private sector that pays them a lot more. So those are just some of the top priorities that come to mind.
As we talk about water quality, I was thinking about there are some natural pollutants. Maybe they can be called natural pollutants, which are geese and seagulls. And I say that because they're often up on the lakefront, and that can cause water levels, E. coli, to go up. Is there anything being done to address that type of pollution?
We haven't invested in energies there, and that's really because of the fact that wildlife manure essentially is a very, very small percentage of overall manure pollution. It's simply dramatically dwarfed by pollution from factory farm manure waste. Even in the Lake Michigan watershed, you've got all these different rivers and streams that, you know, some of them are adjacent to these massive factory farms. And, you know, when you're inadvertently overspreading manure on a farm field, it could leach into not only groundwater, but it could run off in the event of a flood or a storm into our waterways. And that could eventually end up in Lake Michigan. So that's where we've really put our energy, which is to try to get Indiana to enact common sense policy that reduces air and water pollution from things like factory farms.
I don't know if I'll swim the same again in Lake Michigan, because if there's manure and I'm floating around with that, that just doesn't sound right.
Right. And, you know, there's all sorts of challenges with Lake Michigan. There's erosion that is in partly climate change induced. There is invasive species. And of course, there's these toxic industrial polluters that we talked about earlier.
Well, what are your plans now? We mentioned that you're stepping down, you're moving on to another project. What are you planning to do?
I've been really moved by the significance of challenges of the extinction crisis facing the planet, as well as the fact that our globe is really addicted to factory farming. And to just give a little bit of a flavor to that to your listeners, you know, we haven't seen the level of extinction that we are seeing in the world today in 65 million years. That's how serious the extinction crisis is in the planet. And we could lose as much as 1 million species of animals and plants by the end of the century. And furthermore, we've got the situation where about 70 billion animals are killed each year, overwhelmingly in factory farms across the planet. And I think both of these things are wrong. They are not the right direction that our planet should go. It's not good from an environmental standpoint. It's not good from the standpoint of honoring the life of all creation that ought to thrive in this planet. And it's not good for our health. And so I'd like to be a book author that helps to sensitize both children and their parents to these challenges in a very novel way, something that hopefully some of your listeners will read in the coming years. But it's very much driven by these concerns about the extinction crisis and our globe's addiction to factory farming.
Was there a moment that just flickered a light bulb where you're like, this is what I want to do?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there are so many different causes that really can tug at your heart. And it's a bit of a struggle in life to figure out where one should go, since there are so many challenges it faces humanity and the animal world. But I think that what's moved me to focus on these two issues is that there is a time clock here. You know, if we fail to step up in protecting habitats, in changing the way that we deal with poaching, etc., we will lose those species forever. So there's that urgency, I think, that's driving this particular calling.
Do you think children are the future? I don't know if it's a cliche thing to say, because I feel like I heard that when I was a kid. You guys are the future. But do you think a children's book will help shape kids growing up?
I certainly hope so. I think back, actually, you know, it's interesting. As a child, I often read mostly history. I didn't read fiction. But it's fascinating that when I really introspect about what has really moved me to follow this trajectory of public service and serving the community and the greater good and the public good, which has really been the thread of my entire career. It's in some ways rooted in these books that I read from the Value series and the Power series, where you're exposed to what are these timeless values that we as humanity ought to embrace: compassion, courage, truth. And it's just amazing how profound those books had on shaping the trajectory of my life, and my hope that it will have the same influence when I begin to do the same.
What can folks do who are listening and feel inspired to take some form of action but aren't sure where to start?
Well, we would love for them to go to hecweb.org, which is our website. And in particular, we would love for them to register for November 19th and 20th's Green the Statehouse. It's our 14th annual one. It's the largest gathering of environmental-minded Hoosiers every year. And thankfully, for the second year in a row, it's virtual, which means it's incredibly convenient to attend wherever you are. And you'll get to hear from leading experts who can talk about these issues that we've touched on in great depth and leave people inspired, because these are people who are not only know what they're doing, but they are also people who are very upbeat and resilient in the face of the adversities that is the political climate of Indiana.
As we get ready to wrap up here, are you hopeful for Indiana?
I am. I think that what gives me greatest hope is just the number of different constituencies that are really stepping up, whether that's, again, the conservation-minded farmer, the youth climate activists, the pastor and the pastor's congregation that is really wanting to change the way that they care for the environment. I think that the potential for environmental progress in Indiana is limitless. We just have to keep tapping into the potential.
Thank you so much. Jesse Carbonda is the outgoing executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.